ask the questions, and Dwayne's going to give the answers. So that's always a good way to do it. But I want to take the opportunity to introduce Dwayne. I have a little bit of history with Dwayne. I met Dwayne in 1972. I was pastoring a church in Newell, Iowa, and it was that second year when Dwayne and Lois and their children, do you have three at that time? You had three children at that time. They were living in Storm Lake, Iowa. Dwayne was working for his father-in-law in a packing plant. And that was his job. And they came, and it was in that year that they came that he found the Lord and became a follower of Jesus. And it was shortly thereafter that he sensed the call of God to missions. And he took his family of three and his wife, and they moved to Omaha, and he enrolled at Grace College of the Bible at that time. I wasn't sure when the name change took place there, but Dwayne worked full-time and took a full-time load of classes, and God led him through 4 years at Grace. And then they sensed a call to the jungles of South America. He joined with Gospel Missionary Union at that time, which is now Avant Missions, and they left for Ecuador. And he's served with the Achuar Indians in the jungles for the last 35 years and is not finished yet. And God is still leading him back to continue their ministry. And so what I would like to do is to begin with Dwayne sharing with us how they came to believe that God was calling them to the jungles of Ecuador, and to whom and to what that God was calling them to.
First, thanks for the opportunity to be here again. We enjoyed the last time we were here, and really enjoy sharing what the Lord has allowed us to do, what he's doing through us and through all of you that support missions down there. Call to Ecuador, we didn't have email at the time, so it wasn't that. The Lord did convince us through various things in our life that he led us to where to go. And when we were at Bethel Baptist Church, we only felt the Lord directing us into full-time ministry. We had no idea what it was. But we sold our share of the farm. We went to Grace College of the Bible, really expecting to get into a camping ministry. I've always enjoyed wildlife. We had an exotic animal farm, and a lot of camps had that. So I saw us getting into a camp, working that way. But over the years at Grace College of the Bible, they would have a missions conference each year. And the first one, there was a representative from GMU that talked to us, asked what we felt the Lord was calling us into, and we described it in detail, what we thought the Lord had prepared us for, what would we like to get into, which was a jungle ministry or a rural work at least. And he said, no, by the year 2000, 90% of the people are going to be in the cities. You need to go to the cities. That's not what this country boy wanted to hear. I wasn't interested. And we crossed GMU off the list and started applying with Brazil Gospel Fellowship Mission. The next year, that not being accomplished yet, we had another missions conference. Another person came from Gospel Missionary Union, asked us again. We put on detail what we thought the Lord wanted us to do, and he pulled out a piece of paper, a request for people to work with the Achuar that literally looked like I had just written it myself. There was so much down the line, we had no question in our mind that that's where the Lord wanted us to go. So we started on that road. The Lord opened doors for us. We were too ignorant to know how long you're supposed to be on deputation. We had 4 months of deputation before we went to the field. But the Lord had provided opportunity through Grace College of the Bible, working at camps for a couple of years. Churches said, when you get ready to go, we want to support you. And we literally finished language study. 4 months later, we went to the field. But we have had no doubt in our minds since the day we went that that's where God wanted us. And you have to have that. There were times those first years where we would have bailed out if we weren't sure that's where God wanted us. It's not easy. You get tired, still tired of people laughing at you as you stumble with a language or a different culture, things like that. You have to be convinced that's where God wants you. And we have felt that as we're nearing the end of our ministry. We don't know how long we'll be down there, but I'm certain that God will tell us when it's time to quit, just as certainly as he directed us there. So Lord willing, we have many years to work. Part of them on the field, maybe some of them after we get here and back here in translation, but we're still enjoying it. We have a wider open door to ministry now than we have ever had in our ministry, and I can't see calling it quits just because the calendar says we're older than dirt. So we're gonna keep going down there as long as the Lord gives us physical ability.
Can you go into some review of to whom the people that you're ministering to and what your mission is in going?
I don't know if any of you know Frank Drown. He wrote Mission to the Headhunters. He was kind of instrumental in getting us into the Achuar people. We moved into the jungle among the Shuar people. That's where the mission station is. And then we would go out to the Achuar. And Frank had made several inroads to the Achuar people. We calculated there was about 80 villages, and he had regular contact with about five or six of them. So there was a start. But as we went in and saw the need and learned the language, we spent a year and a half learning Spanish. Then we went into the jungle, spent a year learning Shuar. And then at almost 40 years of age, we started learning Achuar, making the differences between Shuar and Achuar. And as we went to the Achuar people, we saw the need for, as usual, the basic evangelism. Outside of those few centers he had visited, there was not a lot of knowledge out there. Basic evangelism, we did that for 15 years, I suppose, just shotgunning around through as many villages as we could possibly get into. And while I was explaining last night, we kind of looked on that as a waste of time because we didn't see a lot of growth. We didn't see a lot of results from our work out there. But looking back from this point, we see how vital that was because we were earning their trust and respect and confidence as we traveled around, lived with them like them. So we were seeing some people come to the Lord, not a lot. We decided we need something more regular, so we transferred into a teaching ministry. And in those 80 villages, we chose 12 villages because of location, size, interest, that we lined up as teaching villages where I would go in and teach Bible courses. Anybody that really wanted to learn could get to any one of those in 5 or 6 hours walk, which is nothing down there. We'll go 2 or 3 days to play volleyball. So they would come to that. Again, we saw much growth there, but we started seeing the only time they're in the class is when there's nothing else going on in the village. If there was a soccer game, any kind of meeting, something like that, they wouldn't come to the class. Most of them weren't interested. It's just something to do. So we looked out over that. There were probably 150 to 200 students intermittently in those courses. And we saw five couples that were already recognized by the people as leaders. And we thought we can pour ourselves into a more personal discipleship with those five. So we started visiting them, inviting them to Makuma, living with us for short periods of time. And we saw tremendous growth and possibility there. They were taking what we were teaching them back to their village and doing more than we ever could have. And we wanted to increase that. So I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, 15, 12 years ago, we established three, leadership training centers. And we right now have between 75 and 100 leaders, potential leaders, and their wives in those four centers. And we can only meet a couple weeks of the year, twice a year in each one of them because of the distance they come. Everything that's involved in taking care of that many people in a village that far into the jungle. But it's encouraging to see people from Peru, Achuar from Peru, walking up anywhere from 2 to 7 days through the jungle for 3 or 4 days of Bible teaching. There's so little food, we only eat once a day, and they turn around and walk back that many days, thrilled to death that they have learned from God's word. And that's a kind of commitment that we don't really see in Ecuador. So the Peruvians have really been a big part. We can't legally go into Peru, but they come to us and then they take the gospel back. And again, they reach many, many more people than if we were still trying to get into every one of the 80 villages. So we have progressed from church basic evangelism, church planning, to discipleship, mentoring, and now we're training leaders, and that's where we will stop. Right now, the leaders are going on their own. They don't really need us. We feel we can help them grow and mature faster if we keep going down there. So as the Lord allows, we will do that. But that's where we started and where we're at right now.
Very good. One of your chosen methods of ministry is personal discipleship. And I know early in your ministry, you spent hours walking trails, barefooted. I'll tell you, this man's feet are like your shoes. The bottom of them, I mean, summer, winter, whenever. You meet Dwayne anywhere, you'll meet him barefooted. That's just the way he lived. And he walked the trails, oftentimes, most of the time, with other Ashuar men. And that's where discipleship took place. And I would like for you to tell us about those journeys and some of those that you discipled.
When we started, we had two options. The airplane is available down there through Mission Aviation Fellowship. And it would be very easy to get on an airplane and fly from this village to that village and minister to the people. But looking back, some of the best times I had were the times I spent on the trails with those guys and gals walking from village to village. So unless it was so far that just it wasn't logical to walk, we walked the trails with them. And like he says, that's where you learn, where you build relationships. I remember walking through flooded areas where on the flat the water was this deep on us, and we're wading through this in the jungle, and you come to a river, and you know there's a log down there someplace that you're supposed to cross this river on, but you can't see it. And the current's going through. I remember one time going over one of these. It was a huge log, but the current was strong. And the guy that was leading me, like he says, I normally went with others for two reasons. I could help them spiritually, and they could help me culturally. I could see no reason for me to go alone unless it was just short little trips where I didn't need somebody. So the two of us are walking. We had been 5-6 hours on the trail, and we come to this great big river. And he cut two branches that had to be 12 or 14 feet long so that we could reach the bottom of the river as we went across this log leaning into the current. And about halfway across, I see him miss and stand up, and the current is taking him back. And I reached over and caught his stick and put him back on the log, and he said, thank you, and we went the rest of the way. How many times they helped me the same way, it wasn't unusual for them to take us by the hand and go across these logs. They learn to walk logs when they're 2 or 3 years old. They start out that way. I was 40 years old before I ever walked my first log, and it was not pretty. I did many three-point landings in the mud. I stuck the landing, as you would say. Neither of us have fallen when it was dangerous. We have fallen when perhaps we needed a little humility. I get to thinking, well, I'm doing pretty good. No, Lord, I didn't mean that. I told the people I walk closer to God than they do because they walk across the log without even thinking about it. I walk across the log with one hand in the Lord's all the time. But just the kind of things, me helping them, them helping us, hunting trips, we're happy together, we get sick together, we get hurt together, everything we did together, and that's what built the relationship that we have today. We're known throughout the jungle, even in villages we've never been. Not that I'm any big thing or anything else, but you have to have that trust, respect, and confidence before you have any right to say anything to them. So we've been building those bridges since the very start. There's endless stories of things that have happened on the trail, good, bad, funny. It's what made us what we are. Whatever they were doing those first years, we were doing it with them. If they're opening runways, I opened 30 runways down there, and that's really something to see the plane come in for the very first time into a village. And if they're clearing trails, I'm clearing trails, just walking across the jungle, out on hunting trips. We've been out for over a week. Just go out a day, full day's walk into the jungle, build a little lean-to, and you stay out there hunting for a week. And evenings, you're laying around talking and joking. It's just building relationships that, for them, is absolutely vital. Here, maybe you can walk through town, knock on doors, introduce yourself, and do something. Down there, that doesn't happen. If you don't have a relationship with that person, they're not going to listen to you. We didn't know that at the time. We didn't know a lot at the time, but God led us through to where we never made any cultural blunders that would have been a death knell for our ministry, and that's possible. Down there, if you're not married to a woman, you don't so much as touch her. You know, and there are just so many things that we developed early on. We decided we are not going to do anything we don't see them do. When they said, let's all do this, we just hung back to see how they did it, and we copied them. We weren't smart enough to do that. The Lord just did that for us. And like we say, we didn't have time to make all our own mistakes. We had to learn from others. But the whole thing was just the idea of mentoring, you know, living with somebody like somebody. They with us in Makuma, us with them out in the villages. And it got so the people didn't even really look at us as strangers in their villages. The kids weren't afraid of us. They would come up around us, and they didn't do that with white people in the early years. A few places it was even dangerous to go into, but I always went in with somebody else, and they would open the door for us. I remember going into villages where they're so worried, what are we going to do with the missionaries? And they said, don't worry about them. They eat everything we do. They even drink tea with us in the morning. And that drinking tea, can I share that? The culture out there, at 3:30 in the morning, we get up and we drink a lot of Wayusa tea, and then we throw up. It's called stomach washing. We do this every day. The other missionaries thought it was the most disgusting thing they've heard in the world, and they told them to stop it, and some villages gave it up. But I searched my Bible cover to cover, and no place does it say thou shalt not throw up. You know, it's a cultural thing. It's not nothing spiritual, nothing else. It's just what they do. They start with a clean stomach every day. I've been doing it for over 30 years. I miss it back here. I'm looking to the first morning down there in the jungle when I can have a good stomach cleaning. But it opened doors. I was accepting them where they were, the same way the Lord accepts us. And I found out that's one of the most important times of the day, because they sit around that fire in the morning as close as we can, because it's clear down to 70 degrees. We get right around the fire and we sit there and drink for sometimes an hour and a half, 2 hours. Sometimes it's daylight before we're done. One day they'll be telling about a hunting trip, and they'll have people rolling on the floor laughing because they're storytellers. The next time they'll talk about a problem they're having with a witch or something in the village, and we'll talk about that. It's an absolutely perfect time. And many of the other missionaries up to that point had missed that. They thought it was disgusting. And I look forward to that. Great times with them around the teapot in the morning. So it's the whole thing of just accepting them. I always say that there's a wall between them and us. Culturally, whatever. We're trying to get them onto our side of the wall and get them saved. Every block you put in the wall culturally makes it that much harder to get across. So we have what the Bible says they need to change, polygamy, drunkenness. You know, that's going to be in the wall they have to get over. But I don't need to bring a lot of my cultural baggage out there and put on them and make it that much more difficult. So God gets all the credit for, I don't know, making us to the point where we can live with them like them. We take no credit for that at all. That was God all the way, and we have seen great results just because of He gave us that ability. So again, it's not anything, you know, boy, aren't we fantastic. No, not at all. The things that we do out there, we couldn't have learned if we knew we had to. God made us that way. So we look at that as a great, we're just thankful to live in the Garden of Eden where God intended people to live anyway, instead of back here where it gets cold in October.
Amen. Good. Tell us a little bit about the development of the church. I know that as we bring people into a relationship with Christ, one of the desires is to build the church. And Jesus said He's here to build the church. So how do you go about taking people that live in the jungles, have no knowledge of Christ, and develop them into church leaders and ultimately work at developing the church?
Those are all good questions. If any of you have answers for them, I'd be more than happy to hear them. It's been a process, and we're doing what we can. God has given us the model in the Bible of what the church should be. We're aiming for that. But with the little tiny villages we work in, we know it's never going to look like a biblical church. You know, we're not going to have enough people that we can have four or five elders, that we can have deacons, that we can have a pianist and ushers. And, you know, it's not going to look like a church back here. We are thrilled when there's a small group of people that meet together, whether the missionary is there or not. To me, that is a church. It's not a structured church. It's not an organized church. And that's the danger. Most of the churches down there are led by whoever happens to be closest to the Lord at that time. and their lives are roller coasters. Some of them have come out of horrible things. Many of them are polygamous. They have more than one wife. Both of the wives might be Christians. A lot of places they are. But what does the Bible say about that? Can they be a leader? Can they be a pastor? Many of them will do fine with the Lord until one of their little kids gets sick, and after all of their life of going to the witch when they get sick, they go back to the witch. They realize they're out of the Lord's will, and they separate from the church. So that leader's gone. Somebody else has to step in. It's a never-ending change. We go into a village, we never know who might be the church leader at that time. Now, there are 10 or 15 villages out there at least that have some sort of stability, and those are the ones that we really like to work with. They are committed. They're more or less qualified, more qualified than anybody else to be leaders, and we see them accomplishing things in their villages and the surrounding villages that we couldn't. So we treat them like leaders. In our leadership training, which we're doing now, I have made a difference between leaders and the office of pastors. I believe the Bible teaches the pastor must be those things in Timothy and Titus. And there's basically nobody out there that is. But you can't say, okay, you can't have a leader. They will have a leader, whether he's qualified or not. So we call them leaders. There's a couple out there that I would say maybe are qualified to the office of pastor. So I'm making a small difference between a leader and a pastor. I think it's important to do that. But at the same time, I don't think we can tell them, you don't have anybody qualified to lead. You just can't have a leader. I was explaining last night, even kids out on the playground, somebody will rise up and be the leader and tell them what they're going to do, set the game, whatever. So if you have four or five Christians out there, one of them will be recognized as the leader, even though they're not qualified to be a pastor. So right now we're working with that. We are aiming for a biblical church. I'm teaching out of the book of Alexander Strock. I don't even remember what it is in English now. Returning to biblical eldership. That's what we're aiming at. That's what I'm teaching. That's what our goal is. And as they develop, as a generation of people come up that maybe aren't polygamous and that, maybe they will have more people that are biblically qualified to be leaders. Right now, we have almost none. So I'm working with what there is. You know, they're not perfect. And I've communicated with the guys on Alexander Strock's team and back and forth talking about this, and they said probably what we're doing is right. The leader of the church is the person who is most qualified, whether he's perfectly qualified or not. If he is the most qualified, he is the one that people look to as their leader, and we treat him as a leader, maybe not necessarily as the office of pastor. But it's hard. We would like to see the churches with two or three elders that are qualified, but right now we'd be happy with just one that is consistently walking with the Lord. The villages are anywhere from four, five couples and their kids, which would be, you know, 30, 40 people with all their kids, up to some of them probably have 20 or 30 couples and have several hundred people. But most of the villages, even the ones where they have a good group going, there's probably only three or four men that even attend church. A lot of women, tons of kids. They have Compassion International working there, and the kids have to go to church to get their stuff from Compassion. So when they give the number of the church in the village, it sounds impressive. There's 50 or 60 people in the church. There are probably 40 of them are kids that are only there so they get their check mark and get their things from Compassion International. And the others are just a few adults, and that's who we work with. So in one way, it's frustrating that we don't have leaders that are well-trained. In another way, it's encouraging because we see those that are there growing and progressing. As they say, we're not after perfection, we're after direction. And as long as they are growing, even imperfectly, even as we are, we're happy to work with that. And that's what the church is going to be for a long time, maybe forever, because they don't have big towns where you can take a selection out of many qualified believers to have elders and have a biblically organized church. But if they meet regularly, whether we're there or not, worshiping God, fellowshipping, learning, growing, we're thrilled with that. I don't know if that answers or not, but the church as we see it does not exist down there. But there are groups of believers that meet in varying stages of organization.
Many of them are leading their fellow people to the Lord. And I know that you've told me before that you've never baptized anybody down there. You've always asked the local leaders to do that. And so can you talk any about that evangelism that's going on with the people, with each other?
At one time when we started inviting the five couples to our place in Makuma, we asked them, we say, we're not going to be here forever. Our only desire is to see a strong functioning church when we leave. I said, what can we do to get you there? And they said, we can do the evangelizing. You don't need to do that. Teach us to be good leaders. It was very similar to God asking Solomon what he wanted, and he asked for wisdom to lead the people. So that's what we started, and at that time I decided that we're not going to do what they can and should be doing themselves. So as they grew to a point where they could do something, we pulled back and stopped. So in a conference, they have regular preaching along with the teaching. I was doing the teaching, and they would put me in regular preaching roles, and I said, no, you guys can do that. You have preachers from all over the place come to these conferences. You guys take turns doing that, and they have done that, and they have grown. Well, he was talking about the baptism. Early on, we went into a village where I was the first white person that had ever been in there, but a couple of the guys had been out, and they were baptized by a missionary. And when I came into the village, they come in with their chest puffed clear out to here saying this person had baptized them. You know, being baptized by a missionary was better. And I actually told my wife at that time, I says, I'm never going to baptize a single one, and I never have. I will teach them how, I will show them how, but I will not do it. And there was one village where there's a converted witch doctor, has led many, many people to the Lord in spite of being almost illiterate. Anytime the Lord thinks I need patience, he would send me down there to work with this guy because he was so demanding, but not for himself, for his people, a great heart. Many people led to the Lord. But I was in there early on, and he said he wanted to have a baptismal service, and I would be doing the baptism, and I said no. And he just looked at me, and he got mad, really mad. And what kind of missionary are you? The missionary has always done the baptizing. And I said, that's right, it's about time you do it. Andik, one of the other leaders, was there with me. We gave him a little mini course on baptism. We met with those that wanted to be baptized, taught him what baptism was, the significance. And then when it was time for baptism, he went into the water, and Andik, the Achuar pastor, went into the water with him. They baptized two or three people. Andik came out, and the guy's son-in-law, who was a leader of a neighboring church, went in, and they baptized the rest of them. And when he came out of the water, he was just beaming, something he had actually done. It would have been much easier for me to do it for them, make a great prayer letter. I baptized 10 people today. Here's a picture of it. We've never been interested in that. And a lot of times the easy way is not what the church needs. So we have pulled back. Anytime they get to the point where they can and should be doing something, I will no longer do it. And that scares me about somebody coming in to take our place or somebody coming in after we leave, because a new missionary is asked to baptize the people and they will say, of course, I'd be happy to. And they'll take the church back 20 years. So we aren't looking for anybody to replace us right now. We feel they can go on their own. Do you allow Bible reading in the church here? Yeah. Okay. If somebody read Acts 20:32. If somebody's got that and can read it in a good, clear voice. That's what we're teaching them as we're getting ready to leave. I think Paul set an example there that we need to follow up. Who's got a good voice that can read that? Acts 20:32. That's the verse. That's not the one I was after. Is that 20:32? Or Paul says, I commend you to the Lord and his Spirit. I thought that was Acts 20:32.
And now I entrust you that's to God and the message of his grace that is able to build you up and give you an inheritance with all those he has set apart.
Yeah, I entrust you to God. He was saying goodbye to the elders in Ephesus. He said, you'll never see me again. I entrust you to God. He didn't say, go out and find another apostle, go out and find another missionary. He says, I have trained you. I have proclaimed the entire gospel. You're ready now. I entrust you to God. Go. And that's what I'm telling the people. You don't need another missionary. They don't need somebody coming in that's going to take them back and start all over with John 3:16 and the basics and work up to where they are now. So as we leave, that's one of the things that's keeping us there. We know there are many groups around the outside, many cults, false groups, and even groups with a good gospel just waiting to come in once we leave. And they're going to take them backwards. So we're trying to get the leaders to the point where they will stand against anybody that comes in with either a poor gospel or trying to take them back to basic one and go from where they're at. So that's one of the things that we're facing in there. But we just decided we will not do something they can and should be doing, and that has been good. It's forced them, just like you raise your kids. At some point, you have to tell them, you can do this. I'm here to help you. If you don't, I'll guide you, but this is yours. You have to do it, and it's great to see them when they do, even when they fail. You know, they're growing, they're learning, and that's what we're seeing down there now.
You mentioned the false religions and the cults that are coming into that area. Can you talk a little bit about the false religions and the threat that that's placing upon the development of the believers?
Yeah, the big one would be Catholicism. That has been there as long as the gospel has been there. The priests and Frank Drown kind of entered into that area at the same time. So there's the Catholic doctrine. That doesn't worry us a lot because we can go to the Bible and clearly tell them where the differences are. We have other groups down there. We have Mormons. We have Jehovah's Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventists. Those are the three main ones. We even had Muslims come in at one point about an hour's walk from Makuma. They come into the village, and they promised every single man in the village a chainsaw if they would let them build a Muslim temple, a mosque in their village, and they almost got away with it. We heard about it. We got some information, wrote it up about their teaching, translated into Shuar, and gave it to their own Shuar leaders. They went out there, and just barely they convinced the people they didn't want that, so they didn't get in. But the other areas, the people are looking for stuff. They're very materialistic. They have had nothing. And as they're starting to get out and the outside is coming in, they're seeing other things that now that they've seen them, they want. And they're looking for people that it'll give it. And all of these cults are more than willing to buy their way into a village by giving stuff. So that's one of the things we're working at, trying to keep it away. I have several courses, Know the Marks of the Cults by Dave Breeze. There's a very good one. We basically translated that into Shuar, and I translated into Achuar. I've taught that. We tell them there are so many false religions, you can't possibly study each one, but if you know these basic points, you'll be able to identify them when they come in. And I use it like a false bill. We're getting false money down there now, fake money, a counterfeit. We use U.S. money. I tell them I went into a store in Omaha, and I paid for something, and they gave me a bill, and I took it, and I gave it right back, and I said, it's fake. They said, how do you know? And I said, it just doesn't feel right. I have never studied fake money, but I have handled enough of the true, the real money. When I came in contact with the fake, I knew it immediately. And that's what we're telling them. If you know these basics about good, sound gospel, when something else comes in, you're going to recognize it. And we're spending a lot of time teaching them the very, very basics so that when these others come in, they'll be able to identify it. They have a habit of welcoming anybody as long as they get stuff. When the people stop giving them stuff, then they kick them out and wait for somebody else to come in. So you can see our fear about others coming in when we're gone. There's the sound, mature believers don't want that. But there are so many new believers and so many non-believers in the village that those few cannot keep that out. We had one village where the leader said, no, they didn't want that to come in. And the people said, all right, you give us everything they're promising them. And he couldn't do it, so that they come in. And to this day, that village is a mess because they had this other religion come in. So it's really hard. As we see, it's going to happen. There's nothing we can do to stop it. We're trying to do everything we can to teach them and prepare them for it so when it comes in, they can handle it.
It certainly raises some concerns about what's going on in our own nation. How many people are drawn to different teachings because of what they can receive?
That stuff.
Switching gears just a little bit, tell us about some of the challenges and the opportunities of living in the jungle for you and for Lois.
Okay, we talked about that a little bit in the car on the way here, the challenges. And I would say for me, there were very few. I've always been able to adjust. Again, that's something the Lord gave us. I've been able to live with the people, like the people, without any extra stress. It doesn't bother me to go down to the river and get a drink out of the river when I know somebody upstream is using it for a bathroom. You know, I go down there. If somebody's doing that, I will go upriver from them. But I know someplace upriver further, it's at, that doesn't bother me. It never has. So I haven't had the adjustment. Lois, on the other hand, has had quite a few adjustments, not from that so much. But the main thing that she had to learn was cooking. You cook over a three-log fire. She has to go out and get her own firewood. Starting a fire in the early wet mornings is not easy in there. Just the different food she had to learn to prepare. We have each been given the ability to eat basically anything. We can honestly say, well, with one exception, we have not been given anything that we didn't actually like. We enjoy the food. We don't have to force ourselves to eat it. We had tapir spleen. If you ever get a chance to eat tapir spleen, you might pass up on that. It's not a dish you're going to see in the fancy restaurants. It was edible. We ate it. But other than that, really, what they give us, we don't take food with us. We eat whatever they're eating. They give us our food. And that has gone a long way to opening doors, too. We don't bring a lot of food in and say, no, we can't do that. We have to have our own. Whatever they have. According to tradition, if there's no meat, the men don't eat. So I've been out there up to 3 days without eating because there's no meat. But their men don't eat. I don't eat. We have a thick banana drink I can drink that keeps me full, so it's pretty good that way. Some of the cultural things, it's a little hard, challenging, because they're not the same from one village to another. Again, we kind of hang back and see how people are doing things before we get in there. Some places eat deer meat. Some places that's taboo. Some villages eat one thing, others don't. We just hang back and see what they do, and we do the same thing. Some villages, it's okay for men and women to go together down to the river to bathe. Some places, they don't. So these are just things that somewhere along the line, God gave us the wisdom to just wait and see how they do things, and we've gotten along. We're very just adaptable. Again, God made us that way. We have life very primitive out with the Achuar. We come back to Makuma where we have a primitive house, which would be like a barn here that we live in. The villages around the edge of the jungle is a different culture. Up in Quito, it's very similar to here. And we have been able to slide in and out of those without a lot of thought. People really ask us, what do you really miss? And we said, nothing. We never sit down there thinking, boy, I wish I had a Big Mac. You know, it's just, and that's God again. He prepared us for where he sent us, and he does that. He will never send anyone where he has not prepared you to go, and he goes with us. So the challenges haven't been as many as you might think. That's one of the things that directed us to Ecuador. We could see that God had given us these abilities and these gifts, if you will, to live out there where other people maybe didn't want to or even couldn't. So that's what took us there in the first place. The challenges haven't been a lot. Anytime we go someplace, even here in the States, going down to language school and everything, we expect to live in a tent. Then anything we find is so much better than that, we're happy. We see so many people go down there with high expectations and they're disappointed time after time after time. We go out expecting nothing. And whatever we find is so much better than that we're encouraged. We're okay with that. And Lois has had probably more of that, more to do with that than I have. I come from a rural setting anyway. I had never lived in a modern house until I was a senior in high school. So a lot of the jungle living, you know, was not that new for me. Hers was a little more, but she's adapted completely to living with the people like the people, and that was necessary. She had to learn the respect of the women just like I did the men. You know, I talk about the women carry all the water up from the river, so they said that's a good place for you to teach them that the man should carry the water for the women. And I said, chapter and verse on that, please. You know, God didn't send me down there to change their culture. He sent me down there to make disciples. I said, she has to earn the respect of the women just like I do. If she can't even carry her own water up from the river, what are the women going to think about her? It was interesting to see after some of the men got saved, they started carrying the water up from the river for their wives. Why? Holy Spirit was making a change in them. They wanted to help. If I'd have told them to do it, they'd have done it, but not for the right reason. So we're interested in just getting them saved, and then if a believer does something out of line, I will confront them. But for a non-believer to do some of the things that they normally do, that's expected. You know, I can't tell them not to do that because they're not saved. They can't change themselves. So that some of the challenges that way, the opportunities are just the same as they are here. There's unsaved people every place. There are people in every stage of development, from baby Christians on up. Some of them have been Christians for 20 years and never grown. Some of them just go by leaps and bounds. Everything is an opportunity. I remember going into where Walter is. He's our Atshar, our Shivyar couple. We work with Atshar Shivyar. And I'd go in there with him. We'd get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to drink tea, and we wouldn't go to bed till 9 o'clock at night. And every spare minute we had, he got out a little notebook. He reads through the Bible, and when he has questions, he writes it down, and then he would ask me these questions. I would leave there just absolutely beat, but happy, you know, to have people that dedicated that they would read the Bible on their own and write questions down when they don't understand. That's the desire of every pastor, you know, to, for his work. And he was the one of the newer Christians of the five couples, and he has risen to where I would say he is the leader. He's the best of them all. And that's just because he was in the Word daily. If he didn't understand, he wrote it down. Sometimes I could explain it. Sometimes I'd have to tell him, I'll get back to you on that. I learned early on there's nothing wrong with saying I don't know, but I'll find out. So it's been a joy working with them. There have been opportunities like that. Seeing them, Lois was here for 16 months with cancer, 17, I don't remember what it was. And then again, 9 months for leishmaniasis, where she got a parasite that took all the front of her leg off. Those two times we were back here for long periods of time. We went back and the people told us about all the things they had been doing while we were gone. They had conferences. They had Bible studies. They're evangelizing the villages around them. It's just terrific to see that. That was our goal when we went there, and we're seeing it now. Another province doesn't have that because they've always depended on the missionary who gave them everything. We give the people in our province absolutely nothing. I say, I will work with them. I will help them. I will give them discounts on the things I sell to them, but I will not give them free anything. And because of that, they have a dependence on the Lord instead of the missionary. Another missionary wisely said, the process of building a church building, they're talking about the edifice now, the process of building it is more important than having it. Because as they build it, under their own strength, they wait on the Lord to provide, they pray, they see their needs met. The next time a need comes along, they're going to go back to the Lord and ask for that again. If a missionary comes in and says, I will give you a church, bang, they have a church. The next time they have a need, where are they going to go? Back to the missionary. So we have been encouraged to see the province we work in mostly going ahead on their own. They've even established a church association now for some kind of stability to keep false doctrine from coming in. The other province is more challenges. They have a lot of other people, different doctrines coming in, and the church has very little unity. But we're working on that. We still have some challenges, but the blessings outweigh them by far.
I think one of the interesting perspectives is to ask a church in a foreign field, as they view the church in America, what words would you like to say if you were meeting with us? And I'd like to hear that from Duane's perspective and from the Oshawars. What would they say to us in Heston, Kansas? That would be a word of wisdom and a word from the Lord for us.
Well, from us as missionaries, I would say the people are to where they can do it themselves, leave them alone. I had an aunt that used to tell us when we went down there, what are you doing? Leave them alone. They're happy the way they are. Well, no, they weren't. But now they're to the point where they can go on their own. There are places that need missionaries coming in initially. That's fine. But once they get to the point where they can go on their own, you need to pull back and let them, or the church will always be dependent on outside. Every village in there would be happy to have their own missionary living in the village that can get them things they need. That's not what makes a strong church. So we would say, if you really want a strong church, go in, disciple them, take them up like Paul did to where they can do it on their own, turn them over to the Lord and back off. What they would see, what they would say is two. The mature believers would say, we've got it now. If you want to help us, continue to teach us to be good leaders, teach us doctrine, teach us things like that, but we can do the boots on the ground work. The new believers and the non-believers in the villages are still looking for stuff. And that's where anybody from here goes down there, whether they're a cult or whether they're a good, sound church. If they go into a village and ask them what they need, they will hear those two things. There will be one or two strong believers that say, we've got it. But all the rest will say, yes, yes, come in. Nobody ever visits here. Nobody ever comes here. I was in the jungle going to another village. It was a two-day walk. We had to sleep on the trail in between. I called by radio to let them know I was coming. They said, we need you to wait a day because another missionary who is sound in doctrine, but not maybe in practice the way he does it, was in the village at that time. He said, we got another missionary here. Can you wait? So I waited a couple days and finally went there, spent 3 or 4 days there. And when I left, they said, be sure to come back again. Nobody ever comes here. So their idea of nobody ever comes here is they don't have anybody there permanently. And people from the outside, from North America, even the missionaries that live outside the jungle down in Ecuador, they talk to the people and they say, well, nobody ever comes here. We have to go in and do something. And we say, no. People do come in here. Their own people are going back and forth between villages. They are almost all tied into families, and the families go back and forth. But they think if there's not a permanent missionary in that village, it's an open village. They need somebody to go in there. And they're disrupting the church. It has wreaked havoc in so many places down there. Churches are underway. People are growing. Apologies are being given for things in the past, and somebody else will come in and start all over, and bang, kills it dead. And they start from square one again. So that you get the two responses. Our response would be, after they're to that point, leave them go. They can do it. Their response would be, we've got the basics. We could still use somebody to continue giving us more in-depth studies, but we've got the boots on the groundwork. And then the others would say, yes, we need somebody all the time. So it just depends on who you ask. You ask them a yes or no question. The way you ask the question will tell them what you want to hear. So they say, do you need a missionary? Well, of course you want to hear yes, so they will tell you yes. Even the believers will do that, not thinking it's a lie. Well, I'm telling them what they want to hear. That's what I should do as a Christian. But it doesn't work that way. You have to live with them, like them, for a time before you understand that you have to talk around something to find out what it is. You can't just ask straight questions and get an honest answer. And that's what people from North America, from others outside the jungle, they go in, ask direct questions. The people tell them what they think they want to hear, and they go in with a group and they split the church or take it back. So it's tough. It's nothing different than back here, really. You have those that are, given a feel-good gospel, all emotions, feeling good, whatever. And then you have those that are hammering the word. We have gotten away from videos, from films, having big soccer tournaments to get people in there. We don't need to do any of that. God calls, God convicts, God saves, God guards. He does everything. All we do is present the gospel. We don't need to trick people to coming in to get them to hear the gospel. Once the Holy Spirit has prepared their hearts, He will get them to where they hear the gospel. I got a new term that I learned that I think works out well, and it's called spiritual abortion. We try to push people into a sinner's prayer or salvation before the Holy Spirit has prepared them. And they might go through the motions and say the words, but nothing has happened. They're not ready yet. So naturally, we want people to come to the Lord as soon as possible, but we also have to be willing to wait until they come to a point where there's true repentance and salvation. It's measuring that back and forth that unless you live with the people like them, you really can't determine where that is. That might have answered it. It might not.
Well, Duane, I really appreciate you sharing with us and being very open and vulnerable about the ministry. It's real, and you're real, and we appreciate that. We wanted you to take the opportunity to visit with them after we close the service.
And my wife, too. She can fill in a lot of the blanks, so I grill her.
There you go.
She thinks she escaped, but don't let her out without the time.
So thank you for allowing us to have this time of conversation with you, and I trust it will be an encouragement and a blessing.
Thank all of you, too.
Okay. Thank you.